on our capacity to know and value ourselves. Some relationships can enhance our capacity for self-knowledge, while others, like the relation between a master and slave, or between the emperor and his subjects, distort the picture we have of ourselves. But what's really interesting about this is the fact that it is the master and not so much the slave whose self-understanding is distorted by the relationship. Let's see why. From the standpoint of self-knowledge, the individual becomes aware of herself as an individual. She becomes self-conscious at the moment when she confronts another like herself, a subject capable of interpreting and understanding the world. In this meeting, the two are aware of each other, but that awareness carries with it a certain tension. Insofar as the other is a co-interpreter of the world, she is a subject for whom the world presents itself. On the other hand, insofar as the world remains an object to her, the other is likewise an object within the world. When, for instance, Luke and Vader first meet in The Empire Strikes Back, Vader is torn. On the other hand, he regards Luke as a trophy, a mere object of conquest. On the other hand, he also sees Luke as a potential rival to the Emperor, an equal and partner. In any case, at this point, the individual is only aware of herself in terms of her capacity to interpret and understand the world. What she lacks is an understanding of herself as an active creator, that is, as a being with meaningful projects and goals. Yet in order to know herself in this way, the individual must somehow fashion a world according to her own will. She must, in other words, make for herself a human world. Then and only then will her individuality emerge and itself become something to be interpreted and understood by another. The problem is that being creative in this sense requires that we impress our will on others by ordering our world. In this respect, we are all like the emperor, attempting to remake the world in our own image. The struggle begins. Each refuses to see the other as a co-equal subject, and each sees in the other the means to create a world of their own design. Both risk all in the life or death struggle for supremacy, for it is by such a struggle that, Hegel thinks, we come to know and value life with all its creative possibilities. In the end, one reaches the brink of terror and backs down, only to become the slave of the other. This, in simple terms, is how Hegel understands the historical emergence of the relation between masters and slaves. It's tempting to think at this point the master has what he wants. As master, he can command the labor of the slave and make the world into what he wills. Freed from the drudgery of mundane work, the master can live in lavish surroundings, indulge in fabulous pleasures, and do pretty much as he pleases. Think Jabba the Hutt. It certainly looks as if the master has what he wants, just as it looks as if the emperor, with his crimson-clad guards and fawning courtiers, has what he wants. But appearances can be deceiving. It was to be recognized by another, an equal, that the master risked everything to become master, not to live a life of pleasure. The slave is a human being, but as long as he remains a slave, he cannot give the master the recognition he desires, the recognition of an equal. Why does this matter? Hegel expresses it in this way. Self-consciousness exists in and for itself when and by the fact that it so exists for another. That is, it exists only in being acknowledged. Although I am surely something independently of others, the understanding I have of myself, of the value of my projects, of the meaning and sense of my experiences, is dependent upon the way others see me. Naturally, I must trust in and value the judgments of those who evaluate me. If I judge them to be unequal, incapable of understanding or passing judgment upon the value of my life, then their opinions are worthless to me. Only an equal is capable of understanding me in the way I understand myself. Thus, if I am to gain the recognition I desire as a self-conscious being, if I am to understand the truth about myself and my possibilities as a human being, then I must seek out an equal. But this is impossible for the master. By definition, the master prefers death to the slavish recognition of another superiority, and it is only through death, his death, or that of his adversary, that the master achieves what he wills, lordship. The possibility of peaceful coexistence with co-equals, with other masters, is likewise foreclosed. The original struggle for, a one-sided, recognition is merely transplanted to a new site. For as long as the master refuses to recognize the other as a co-equal subject, for as long as he wills that he be master, his most important human aims are, and will forever be, frustrated. Of course, it goes without saying that the slave's aims are likewise frustrated. Being a slave is only a happy state of affairs and bad histories. In reality, slavery is a brutal and inhuman institution, and the brief glimpse of slavery on Tatooine that we get in The Phantom Menace is tame and whitewashed. Nevertheless, the situation for the slave is also not what it might at first seem. To begin with, it is the slave whose labor creates the world of things, and through that labor he comes to experience himself as a creative being. This is certainly the case for young Anakin working in Watto's shop. While the master cannot in the end be satisfied with himself, for he can choose only to live a life of animal pleasure or fight anew and die in the field of battle, the slave can go beyond himself and his situation by overcoming his fears. In The Empire Strikes Back, Luke's experience in the cave and his subsequent Jedi training symbolizes his own struggle with and overcoming of fear. His fear at first enslaves him and prevents him from acting as a Jedi Knight. Although Luke claims that he is not afraid, Yoda knows better and warns,
"You will be. You will be."
His overcoming of that fear, in turn, constitutes an important part of his maturation, and in their duel on Cloud City, Vader praises Luke for overcoming his fear. Consequently, it is the master who represents an historical dead end. He can never go beyond what he is and realize himself as a free, self-conscious subject. The slave, on the other hand, has nothing to lose but his fear. He can and will go beyond what he is because his desire is not to be master, but to be free. Hegel says that he finds this freedom in his work, a space for which he controls his small, limited world, and recognizes the freedom of having a mind of one's own. An empire of fear and trembling. The management of fear is the business of the empire. And fear is the coinage of power that must make itself visibly terrible in order to rule. The emperor, precisely because he is unequal in relation to his subjects, cannot exert his power at all times. Within such a system, it's the exceptional, the example or spectacle, which must circulate and demonstrate power. The decision to destroy the planet Alderaan, for instance, was not made because it constituted a threat, but because its visibility made it a useful show of force. "Dantooine," Grand Moff Tarkin announces, "is too remote to make an effective demonstration. True, the exercise of power is excessive, but it isn't indiscriminate. Its use is calculated to maximize fear and render unnecessary the actual deployment of force elsewhere. Fear will keep the local systems in line. Fear of this battle station." Like all weapons of mass destruction, the Death Star's military function cannot be easily separated from its political and policing functions, its purpose as a method of domestic control. Its objective power lies not in its actual use, but in the threat of its use. And herein lies the secret of its political function of justifying the exercise of power. "This station," says one overly zealous commander, "is now the ultimate power in the universe. I suggest we use it." The suggestion could be ignored, but not the implication. By its very existence, the Death Star invites use and seemingly justifies the extension of imperial power to every corner of the galaxy. The power to destroy a planet is the power to render obedient entire populations. When wielded by the master, it shows who his enemies are, and in doing so, it explains and justifies the master's power by revealing its strength. The Death Star is the most spectacular display of a power that is not afraid of being seen as terrible. But it isn't the only display of that power, nor the only way by which that power makes itself felt. The Emperor's control over individuals, unlike that exercised over entire populations, must be managed with a degree of flexibility that corresponds with the interest he has in extracting even more useful labor from them. In order to make those individuals useful and cooperative, the Emperor may replace the specific dread of a well-defined threat like the Death Star with the more constant terror of the unknown. "The Emperor is coming here. a surprise commander asks at the beginning of Return of the Jedi.
Yes,
Vader replies.
And he is most displeased with your apparent lack of progress.
The threat is undefined and left to play upon the commander's imagination. Almost without hesitation, he responds,
We shall double our efforts!
And then a second ill-defined threat is voiced and left to hang in the air.
I hope so, Commander, for your sake. The Emperor is not as forgiving as I am.
Vader's forgiveness is legendary, after all. In still other cases, the threat is defined, but its meaning left unclear. In his confrontation with the Emperor, Luke's fear of seeing the rebellion fail, of becoming like his father, and of seeing his sister turn to the dark side all become real. But what would it mean to become like his father? Does the end of the rebellion mean the end of all rebellion? What exactly does it signal? If the rebel fleet is destroyed, are his friends necessarily killed? Can the Emperor find Leia, and if so, what would it mean to turn her to the dark side? In no case is Luke confronted with a specific and implacable sign of what's to come. Rather, a web of fear is spread by the Emperor's taunting in order to elicit Luke's anger and call forth that all-too-human power to override reason and give in to hate. If the mechanism of fear explains how it is the Emperor rules his empire and primarily relates to his subjects, it is hatred that explains his relation to his closest advisors and minions, Darth Maul, Count Dooku, and most especially, Darth Vader. Neither equality nor recognition, but instead hatred ties each to the other, because hatred is the primary way by which each makes sense of themselves and the world. Each is driven by his own hatred of life, of all things good, and, it is likely, of himself. Not surprisingly, then, each sees in the other a reflection of himself, something to resent and hate, perhaps, but also something intelligible and understandable, a kind of common ground. Earlier, we saw that the Master seeks after equals with whom he can relate as a self-conscious being. If Hegel is right, and the Master can never be satisfied with himself and his life, then it's not surprising that the Emperor should come to hate life and himself. In other words, it's reasonable to think that hatred will become the primary way by which the Master understands his experience of the world and himself. Consequently, that same hatred will constitute the sole means by which the Master relates to others as self-conscious beings, that is, as relative equals. Naturally, those relations will be seriously impoverished and deficient, as indeed they are. Even so, because those relations are formed around the principal focus by which each understands himself, in this case hatred, those relationships will be more personal, stronger, and more enduring than any other relation each might have. More than anything else, this explains the Emperor's power over his minions and their respective allegiances to him. As Vader confides in Luke,
I must obey my master.
We might see this more clearly if we think carefully about the evolution of Darth Vader and his eventual betrayal of the Emperor. Vader starts off in A New Hope as a dark embodiment of everything evil. In his first cinematic act, he crushes a man's neck while questioning him about the whereabouts of some stolen plans. From there, things only get worse. With the hindsight of the later films, we know he allows the death of his stepfamily, Owen and Beru Lars, interrogates and tortures his own daughter, kills his old friend and mentor, Obi-Wan, and nearly kills his son in the Death Star trench. In The Empire Strikes Back, Vader does no better. In a number of instances, he simply kills those subordinates who fail him in a kind of idealized form of corporate downsizing. And so, by the time we reach the last installment of the saga, Return of the Jedi, and are aware of Luke's parentage, we're given almost no reason to think that Luke is anything more than deluded in believing there is still good in him. On the contrary, the so-called struggle Luke senses in his father is buried so deeply that, up until the point where Luke lays prostrate before a murderous emperor, we're given no indication that Vader is anything more than a willing servant of evil. Then, and only then, does Vader act to save his son. So why does he do it? Or better yet, how does Vader surmount the emperor's hold over him? There's really only one possible answer. Vader overcomes the Emperor by overcoming his hate and achieving a new self-consciousness. Confronted with his son's unshakable belief in his goodness, Vader comes to realize the truth about himself. He isn't a pawn of evil, but a man of inherent goodness and nobility. Vader turns on the Emperor when he becomes aware of himself as something other than a hate-filled man, something other than a slave. And that awareness comes at precisely the moment when Vader comes face to face with the possibility of watching die the only person who saw goodness in him, his son Luke. Luke and Vader's personal struggle with their own fears is at the heart of the larger story about struggle and conflict between the rebels and the Empire. The resolution of that personal struggle represents a moment of self-discovery for both characters, a moment when each comes to understand, in virtue of their relation to one another, who they really were. And the same can be said for the larger struggles that are taking place within the saga. The Ewoks, for instance, prove who and what they are in their confrontation with the Empire. Similarly, the Naboo and the Trade Federations reveal something of themselves in their responses to the collapse of the Republic and the rise of the Sith. This, it seems, is what Hegel was trying to tell us in the relation between masters and slaves. It is the slave, and not the master, who is in position to reveal something about our possibilities as human beings. Fear may create and sustain relations of inequality, but the desire to know who and what we are will, in the end, likely triumph. Chapter 14. By Any Means Necessary. Tyranny, Democracy, Republic, and Empire. Kevin S. Decker. Palpatine, the weasel-like senator from Naboo, the rapidly wrinkling Supreme Chancellor, and ultimately the cackling, loathsome Emperor, is reviled universally by fans as the epitome of evil. Still, you've got to give him credit for his political savvy. After all, Palpatine's career is a textbook case in how the unceasing desire for power can change something like democracy, or rule by the many, into a tyrannical dictatorship. Using the constant threat posed by the dark side of the Force, the Sith, Palpatine and his protege, Darth Vader, use the hyper-technological Imperial military to keep iron-fisted, monochromatic control over the galaxy. How different this vision is from the diverse and colorful, if conflicted, Old Republic of the prequel trilogy. This same kind of political 180-degree turn has occurred in human history, too. Politicians, political scientists, and theorists over many centuries have grappled with how this could have happened, in most cases in order to prevent it from happening again. But the story of the road to tyranny isn't just of historical interest, even though democracy and tyranny date back to ancient Greece. It also embroils us in heady debates of today about the source of political authority, whether the needed expertise of politicians is a good trade-off against the possibility of their corruption, and how much power can safely be concentrated in the hands of a few. These arguments often boil down to the question of who rules versus who should rule. This isn't an easy question, because it presumes that we've settled on what kind of government is best: democracy, republic, aristocracy, or some other. Also, it presumes that we know whether rulers need some virtue or expertise in order to rule, or could everyone simply rule themselves? Political life in the Star Wars galaxy provides us a jumping-off point in approaching these central questions of political philosophy. Galactic Politics for Dummies. Despite their lukewarm reception by the fans, episodes 1 through 3 in the Star Wars saga tell us the most about the political forces that fundamentally drive its episodic stories and overall narrative. With the blockbuster episodes made in the late 1970s and 1980s, there wasn't much to say. The Cold War-style political message of Star Wars at that time was fairly simple. Big evil empires that rely on soulless technology and dominating control over their populations are bad, and rebellion against such empires is justified. By contrast, episodes 1 through 3 deliver a more complex message about the human failings and weaknesses that help to undermine a huge, declining federation of civilizations. To answer the question of how a democratic form of government can slide into empire, we have to define a few terms and make a few guesses about the nature of the Republic. In our galaxy, the word Republic originates from the Latin Res Publica, the realm of public life outside of private affairs. The term's meaning is roughly equivalent to what we would call the Commonwealth, or common good. Palpatine's government may be a republic in this simple sense alone. It recognizes and works for the common good. In Attack of the Clones, Anakin voices an idea of what a good republic ought to do. We need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problem, agree to what's in the best interest of the people, and then do it, he says to Padme. But one might argue that republicanism means more than just recognition of the common good. Government should be built on the idea that the freedom of its citizens is essential, they say, but their freedom depends on their taking part in government. Their participation includes protecting themselves from the arbitrary influence of others. Such protection can be secured in lots of different ways, perhaps most importantly through justifiable restrictions on the power of both government and certain collective interests like corporations and special interest groups. However, the Republican tradition in political thought also stresses that citizens must be active participants in political life according to moral or civic duty. Rather than simply defining what republics have been historically, this way of thinking has moral importance. It makes a statement about how political life contributes to the good life and what we ought to do to achieve it. The problem, writes Jean-Jacques Rousseau in the 8th century, is to find a form of association which will defend and protect with the whole common force the person and goods of each associate, and in which each, while uniting himself with all, may still obey himself alone and remain as free as before. Rousseau poses the thorny question of how to balance the group needs that we all share and that can't be served without collective action with the dignity and autonomy, or self-rule, of the individual. The Republic also seems to have certain features of a democracy. Democracies need two ideals as essential ingredients of their laws and institutions: self-government and equality. Since every inhabitant of Naboo, Coruscant, Dantooine, Kashyyyk, and all the others can't be expected to vote on every issue before the Senate, they interpret self-government the same way we do in America, in terms of a representative democracy. This is the preferred option for any large, heavily populated democracy for obvious reasons. There have been direct democracies, though, in which individual citizens do vote on everything. We can't conclude that simply because the Republic seems to be a democracy, every planetary system within it is also ruled by the people. Naboo, for example, democratically elects its queen, but it's implied in The Phantom Menace that the Gungans haven't had a say in the larger political affairs of the planet for some time. So, is the Republic founded on the ideal of equality as well? By this, we can suggest that in a democracy, everyone is born equal in terms of their talents, capacities, social or economic status. Obviously, the set of our natural endowments is virtually unique to each individual. Instead, equality in a democracy usually means equal rights, equal opportunity, and equal standing under the law. Civil rights laws, welfare systems, public education, and trial by a jury of one's peers have all been used to promote this kind of equality. But in the Star Wars galaxy, it's clear that this kind of equality isn't treated as a universal standard. Certain societies, such as the Jedi Order, seem to function based on hierarchical, not democratic principles. There are planets like Tatooine, where slavery is not only legal, but also the basis of the economy. But as Shmi Skywalker points out, Tatooine isn't part of the Republic. And there's also the controversial issue of whether droids or persons have rights and thus deserve to be treated equally with organics. These are all reminders that in reality, democracy has both an ideal meaning and a real landscape. As the examples of the civil rights and women's voting movements of the 20th century show, in both cases, only moral arguments and public protests enlarged our conception of what equality meant, even as large numbers of citizens held that opportunities ought to be restricted to white men. Let's assume that the Republic is a democratic republic, and more than name alone. How do we get from that to the tyranny of the empire? Aristotle provides us with a suitable definition for tyranny. It's the arbitrary power of an individual which is responsible to no one and governs all alike, whether equals or betters, with a view to its own advantage, not to that of its subjects, and therefore against their will. So the idea of a ruler who acts in blatant defiance of the laws, or perhaps in the absence of laws, is central to the definition of tyranny. Ancient Greek tyrants and Roman dictators were often voted into power by means of the laws they later defied, in order to respond to an external challenge to their state, like imminent invasion, or in some cases because of internal threats, such as civil war. In his own route to tyranny, Palpatine and his alter ego, Darth Sidious, have taken a path like the one expressed in the lyrics of an old German song. Against Democrats, only soldiers help. The Sith Lord's alliance with the Trade Federation and his commissioning of the Kamino and Clone Army through the Jedi Sifo Dyas both paved the way for the Clone Wars 10 years later. Lust for power, not high ideals, is Palpatine's primary motivation. Palpatine wants to transform the Republic to obtain power, and he realizes that the only way to establish power over such a large, diverse group of peoples is through the use of military might. One snag: the mainly pacifist Senate won't allow such an army to be mustered, even when they find out that they have the Kamino clones at their disposal. Palpatine can't let this stand in his way, but fortunately his long-term scheming has paved the way for a solution. In Revenge of the Sith, we finally see his plan revealed in its awful magnitude, and its keystone is the power of the clone army to destroy most of the Jedi, allow Palpatine to dissolve the Senate, and suppress any opposition to his declaring himself emperor. Why did the Senate vote in favor of giving Palpatine dictatorial authority, thus allowing him to harness the power he would eventually use to crush them? The answer is a familiar and simple one: fear. Fear as an ally.
"Fear is my ally,"
hisses Darth Maul in the exciting ad campaign that led up to the much-anticipated release of The Phantom Menace. Maul's sentiment is echoed by Grand Moff Tarkin, who in A New Hope says that the finished Death Star will have a deterrent effect against rebellion since fear will keep the local systems in line. Both agree about the political value of fear with Palpatine, who is positively Machiavellian in his scheming toward the Empire, and the way he later controls his domain, and even while he taunts Luke to use his fear and anger as a means to bring him over to the dark side. In this, he is the paradigm of the Prince, the unscrupulous ruler envisioned by Niccolo Machiavelli, 1469-1527, a Renaissance political thinker who advised Italy's Borgia and Medici families. Machiavelli famously declared that if a prince had the choice between being loved and being feared by his subjects, he ought to choose fear. Ever the realist, Machiavelli held that this is because love is held by a chain of obligation which, men being selfish, is broken whenever it serves their purpose. But fear is maintained by a dread of punishment, which never fails. Machiavelli amends this statement, though, by saying that a good ruler ought to avoid those things that inspire hatred rather than fear, such as taking the property or wife of a subject. Today we can hear echoes of Machiavelli's dictum when our leaders convince us to elect them or support their initiatives, not by offering us good reasons, but by playing on our emotions and sympathies. This tactic is held by many to be anti-democratic, as it both disrespects and clouds our ability to make informed, rational decisions. Real democracy is based on our ability to make good decisions, since democratic political authority issues from the will of the people. We're rightly suspicious of such Machiavellian tendencies in our own leaders as a result. Machiavelli's suggestion that clever politicians balance the happiness of citizens with uncertainty about their security has a very old pedigree. The prime example is found in ancient Athens, some 50 years before the advent of direct democracy there in 508 BCE. At the time, the Athenians were divided into three regional factions. The leaders of all three vied for political power, not to institute equality between citizens, but so that the classes they represented would gain by certain changes. Into this powder keg stepped the legendary Greek legislator Solon, held by later Greeks as the greatest of statesmen and the wisest of men, who had already saved Athens from civil war in 594 BCE. Attempting to broker a settlement, Solon was suspicious of the attitude of Pisistratus, the leader of the disaffected working class, who had an affable and engaging manner, was a great friend of the poor, and behaved with generosity even to his enemies. This fooled many Athenians, but not Solon. Pisistratus cemented his place in the people's hearts by wounding himself, then driving a chariot into the Athenian marketplace to denounce an assassination attempt by his enemies to his followers. Like the anonymous red-robed guards that constantly accompany Palpatine, bodyguards were granted to Pisistratus, who used them to seize the Acropolis and establish himself as a tyrant, a single ruler who consults the laws only when it suits him. His position, effectively similar to the old Greek kings of the Iliad and Odyssey, passed to his two sons before the tyranny was ended. Solon, although allowed to live under the tyranny, was powerless to challenge the power of the Pisistratus. In the later Roman political tradition, special powers and single-person rule made up the role of the dictator, which did not have the same negative meaning then as it does now. Dictators were often figures with military power, Julius Caesar, for example, and were appointed indirectly by the Roman Senate for specific purposes, like commanding an army, holding elections, or suppressing sedition. Dictators were to resign their title and powers as soon as their task was completed and the emergency was over. But Caesar, whose appointment to the unheard-of position of dictator perpetuus, perhaps gave us the first hint of the modern meaning of the word, used his powers to effectively destroy the Roman Republic and establish a hereditary empire. Palpatine would have been proud. Was George Lucas unconsciously thinking of his ancient history class in high school when he penned Palpatine's speech accepting radical emergency powers in order to combat the political separatists led by Count Dooku in Attack of the Clones? There, the future emperor declares gravely, "It is with great reluctance that I have agreed to this calling. I love democracy. I love the Republic. The power you give me I will lay down when this crisis has abated. And as my first act with this new authority, I will create a grand army of the Republic to counter the increasing threats of the separatists." The reluctant acceptance of the power he has been secretly hoping for, his noble words in defense of popular rule, and his solemn promise to lay down power when it's no longer needed would not have sounded inappropriate coming from Pisistratus or Julius Caesar. So the irony in this important scene, both in this sense and given what happens in Revenge of the Sith, is palpable. Excuse the pun. It's an essential part of the tragedy of the prequel trilogy, however, that fear exposes the clay feet of the Republic's stone giant. Palpatine's gambit puts a new spin on Machiavelli. Palpatine realizes that an adversarial relationship between himself and the rest of the Republic won't go his way. Sometimes it's better to be loved than feared. But fear can still be his ally as long as he's poised, shoulder to shoulder with senators and citizens, against some external force. Long before the events of the Phantom Menace, Palpatine must have struggled with the same question as Pisistratus did. How can a threat be manufactured that will unite the people behind me and lead to their granting me special powers and a military force? Palpatine's scheming is all the more insidious because, through the Nemoidian Trade Federation, Count Dooku and their allies, he manufactures the threat. But modern democracies in our world have faced real threats to their existence, both external, like war and terrorism, and internal, like crime and political corruption. After Obi-Wan reports in from Geonosis about the genuine threat represented by the Separatists, a senator from Malastair, loyal to Palpatine, claims, "The time for debate about the Military Creation Act is over. Now we need that clone army." Since the Senate won't use the clones preemptively, the hawks among them decide that the threat justifies granting Palpatine emergency powers, an act that is the beginning of the end for democracy in the Republic. Like these fictional senators, we need to ask ourselves the difficult questions. What measures can be justly taken to defend a democracy in troubled times? And is democracy undermined if undemocratic measures are taken in its defense? These are questions as relevant and controversial today as they were a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. Power in the hands of the virtuous few. There's an important scene in Attack of the Clones that contrasts two major answers to these questions we just posed about the defense of democracy.
I don't think the system works. We need a system where the politicians sit down and discuss the problem, agree to what's in the best interest of all the people, and then do it.
That's exactly what we do. The problem is that people don't always agree.
Then they should be made to.
By whom? Who's going to make them?
Someone.
You?
No, not me.
But someone.
Someone wise.
I don't know. Sounds an awful lot like a dictatorship to me.
Well, if it works.
Anakin's thoughts reflect Palpatine's distrust of the politics of the Republic, which were expressed more subtly in The Phantom Menace over the Senate's handling of the Naboo trade embargo. By this point, Anakin seems clearly under Palpatine's charismatic influence, if not of the dark side itself. Anakin voices the view of his mentor that the bureaucratic aspects of a democratic republic hinder it when swift action is needed. Because of this, the republic may be unable to handle internal or external challenges unless it leans on the leadership of its best, wisest, and most virtuous citizens. Padme seems to recoil at his great man solution to political dissent, perhaps by maintaining that democracy has the resources necessary to survive. Their debate is reflected in the confrontation between the very different ideas of two recent political philosophers, Leo Strauss, 1899 to 1973, and John Dewey, 1859 to 1952. Both of them were concerned with the problems and prospects of a kind of democracy we haven't really looked at yet, modern liberal democracy. But Strauss and Dewey understood the term liberal in very different ways. Strauss thinks that political thinkers of the past, particularly Plato and Aristotle, provide timeless questions about the good life and the just state that today's political philosophers should still be concerned about. But he would say modern politics has somehow gotten off the right track, taking its cues from mediocre mass culture, mob democracy, and moral relativism, the belief that no moral view is inherently superior to any other. It's true that these seem to be characteristics of modern culture, but Strauss calls our attention to the ideals that animate the philosopher king of Plato's Republic and the contemplative sage of Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. Both figures are beacons of virtue and wisdom, as well as natural leaders. Their search for absolute and ultimate truth in political life, as in all other areas, has been abandoned for the most part, he thinks. So his sense of liberal attempts to recapture what was at the heart of Platonic and Aristotelian political thought. It expresses our inner impulse toward human excellence as being the end of all our efforts. Strauss says, "The liberal man on the highest level esteems most highly the mind and its excellence and is aware of the fact that man at his best is autonomous or not subject to any authority, while in every other respect he is subject to authority, which, in order to deserve respect or to be truly authority, must be a reflection through a dimming medium of what is simply the highest." Strauss's way of thinking treats democracy as a universal aristocracy, in which all are free to find their proper purpose and place in society, but society itself is structured by the insight that our wisest leaders have into what is essential, most real, or the highest in human nature. John Dewey, called in his time America's philosopher, would agree with Strauss's key idea that an ideal democracy is a universal aristocracy. But much depends on whether we put the stress on universal or aristocracy. Dewey argues, for him, the liberal and liberal democracy means faith that every human being as an individual may be the best for some particular purpose, and hence be the most fitted to rule, to lead, in that specific respect. He also stresses that we should see democracy as merely a way in which those with the greatest political expertise find their way into power. Democracy is more than a kind of political system involving voting and majority rule. It's a way of living that extends farther than politics, one that demands that individuals have the greatest freedom, in terms of equality of opportunity, to continue to grow as individuals and express their individuality. Democracy in this sense is a struggle. It requires our commitment to continually criticize and revise educational, political, and other means for providing opportunities for individuals.
Sometimes these commitments may get in the way of traditional beliefs and values and cause conflicts. But Dewey says, it is also the best path for the attainment of excellence by a democratic citizenry as a whole. But Dewey's view of excellence is not like Strauss's, because it is not solely dependent upon our accepting the wisdom of great and virtuous leaders. Instead, he says that democracy involves faith in the capacity of the intelligence of the common man to respond with common sense to the free play of facts and ideas, which are secured by effective guarantees of free inquiry, free assembly, and free communication. Anakin, particularly in his admiration for Palpatine and other great men, and by his distrust of popular participation in democracy, holds a view comparable to Strauss's. For both of them, greater concentration of power in the hands of a few is justified by the natural ability of those few to lead and their virtues in assessing, judging, and responding to difficult and complex situations. To Strauss, these are the wise, and Anakin sees wisdom and virtue not so much in Obi-Wan or the Jedi Council, but in figures like Palpatine, who promise both the power and the license to correct injustices quickly and immediately. But the common person is apparently not fit to rule herself, according to Strauss or Anakin, and the Straussian statesman is empowered to utilize many means, including deception, the stirring of patriotism, and manufactured threats in order to keep power. Padme may represent a view closer to Dewey's, although she agrees with Anakin in part when she claims in frustration in The Phantom Menace that the Republic is broken. She seems to have changed her mind in Attack of the Clones when she agrees with Queen Jamilia of Naboo's assertion that the day we stop believing that democracy can work is the day we lose it. By opposing the Senate's Military Creation Act from the beginning, Padme may have seized on a version of Dewey's central idea that democratic ends can be reached only by democratic means. Measures that threaten or clearly violate the Republican and democratic principles we looked at earlier may create the facade of democracy, but they line the foundation of the democratic house with coercion, deception, and the establishment of aristocracies of all kinds, of wealth, of influence, or even those of higher education and virtue, as Strauss suggests. Democracies can and should still value virtue and ability, but they should also put their trust in healthy checks and balances on the abuse of power, all at the reasonable cost of lessening the efficiency of democratic leadership. Of course, it's this loss of efficiency that future strong leaders like Anakin Skywalker deplore. When Palpatine seizes ultimate power, Anakin wins, but at the cost of his own soul. For the rest of the denizens of the Republic, the importance of balancing security and democratic principles is a lesson learned the hard way. Palpatine's legacy. Palpatine's rise from democratically elected Supreme Chancellor to Emperor is a gripping, if ultimately tragic, tale of how democracy can be destroyed from within by its own weakness when security is pursued by non-democratic means. It also exposes a flaw in the Straussian thinking of even well-meaning people like Anakin, who watches the watchers. Strauss's virtuous statesmen don't ultimately answer to the common person, but to a higher truth to which only the statesmen are privileged to. What checks are put in on their obtaining power, and who is to say that they are virtuous in their efforts? Only other members of the wise. The bitter truth raised here may stem from the fact that we have become more cynically distrustful of centralized authority, but there is also a deeper point to be made. Virtue is good, we agree, but our vision of human excellence today is much more diverse and plural than it was with Strauss's beloved Greeks. There are many goods worth pursuing, and perhaps some conflict with one another. The democratic challenge for now is to explore how to balance or reconcile these conflicts in order to maximize virtue, not concentrated in figures of authority. As Senator, Supreme Chancellor, and ultimately Emperor, Palpatine's example throws light on the path from democracy to empire, a path paved with fear and insecurity, the illusory endpoint of which is freedom and peace. In some ways, it may seem unsatisfactory to say that democracy is an unfinished project in which we all still have a part to play. In the end, however, admitting this might be the best guard against our own Palpatines, present
and future. Chapter 15. Humanizing Technology. Flesh and Machine in Aristotle and the Empire Strikes Back. Jerome Donnelly. The philosopher Walter Benjamin, 1892-1940, once remarked that in an age of technology, a copy takes on greater importance than the original. The Sony Corporation's mechanical dog created a sensation that illustrates Benjamin's insight. George Lucas's The Empire Strikes Back achieves its powerful effect in a very special way, by making the mechanical and bionic world of science fiction preferable to nature's flesh and blood. Lucas captivates his audience by combining ultra-realism and familiarity with the content of its predecessor, A New Hope. Together, these provide The Empire Strikes Back with an unusually powerful appeal in drawing the viewer into Lucas's strange new world. This compelling verisimilitude leads plausibility not only to the film's action, but also to its underlying themes, especially the theme of humanizing technology, that is, treating the mechanical products of technology as if they possessed life, a capacity for thought and feeling, and rational and emotional interaction with people. In the course of celebrating technology, Lucas develops an opposition between technology and nature, and, at crucial moments, ennobles technology at the expense of nature. Because the theme operates so subtly, in a film of otherwise forceful, gripping plot and effects, analysis requires bringing the theme to the surface in order to realize fully its meaning and implications. The attitude expressed in The Empire Strikes Back represents a break with the dominant philosophical tradition of Western culture, one with roots in Aristotle, and usually referred to as philosophical realism. For Aristotle, the natural universe is shot through with order, meaning, and value. Nature is not only the principle of order and growth in the universe, it is purposive and serves as a guide for human activity. Things in the world are composed of matter. For example, the flesh, blood, and bone of human beings, and form. Aristotle defines form as that which makes a thing what it is. Form is what makes living things develop into what they become. Acorns develop into oak trees, and chicken eggs into chickens, all the while transforming food and water into the different matter of wood, leaf, feather, and flesh. Aristotle observes a hierarchy in nature, extending from the inanimate through vegetable, animal, and human life. The vegetable form, or soul, has the capacity for such activities as nutrition and reproduction, while the animal soul adds to these powers with others, such as locomotion and perception. Human beings combine these powers with the great power of language and rational thought, and are thus at the apex of the natural hierarchy. Artificial products, including technology, can complete what nature is unable to carry to a finish. But Aristotle insists on a basic distinction between things that exist as part of the natural world and those made by human skill, which include art and technology. Art can be wonderful, but it is subordinate to nature, which is both prior to it and its source. Aristotle's sharp distinction between the natural and the artificial would apply to Luke Skywalker's bionic hand, since the limb is produced from a pre-existing form and matter, or material. All manner of products, clothes, ladders, glasses, prosthesis, extend or enhance nature, enabling human beings to keep warmer, reach higher, see better, or even replace damaged or missing natural body parts. I am fluent in 6 million forms of communication. In The Empire Strikes Back, Lucas implies that the world is mostly artificial, a world made up simply of interchangeable parts, a view reinforced by the constant tinkering and fixing of all the intergalactic gadgets used in space travel. Nature is depicted as little more than a nuisance, and technology is superior and necessary to repair the mess that nature continually finds itself in, whether it is a lost limb or repeated threats to the safety of the body and the potential extinction of life. This is in sharp contrast to Aristotle's view of the relationship of art, which would include technology, and nature. While everything in both art and nature consists of form and matter,
They do so in very different ways. Aristotle emphasizes that nature works from within, while art and technology are produced from outside, whether in making a statue with limbs or prosthesis to replace them. Art and technology fall outside of the order of nature and aren't alive. Pygmalion, the ivory statue, which in Greek legend was brought to life by the goddess of love, is only a story. In the real world, statues don't live or love. Only people do. And anyone who fell in love with a statue would be wasting both time and affection. Technology is not only lifeless, it depends on nature as the basis of both its forms and matter. In his Metaphysics, Aristotle uses the example of a bronze sphere to make this point. The production is from bronze, matter, and sphere, form. The form is imported from outside the matter into this stuff, and the result is a bronze sphere. In nature, form operates from within matter. As, for example, an acorn grows from within to become an oak tree. The difference is that between Sony's mechanical dog and a real dog. C-3PO is a more sophisticated version of Sony's mechanical dog. Neither grows from within. Both are produced artificially from without. The issue is not simply one of looking at modern technology with a new admiration. Both real and fictional heroes have famously felt affection for the tools of their trade, admiring the beauty and craft of their weapons, and occasionally speaking to sword or arrow and hoping aloud for victory or a sure hit in the "don't fail me now" tradition. Yet, when technology is accorded the capacity to behave in human terms, the relationship between man and tool changes considerably. The transformation is striking in The Empire Strikes Back, as Lucas substitutes robot for some of the traditional secondary adventure characters, and in so doing, shifts audience response by directing affections away from human characters to these ingenious, often cute, products of technology. The human emotion generated on behalf of technology becomes accentuated by the absence of strong feeling for what should be emotionally charged relationships. Despite the inclusion of traditional adventures from epic and romance, along with a budding love relationship between central characters, Han Solo and Princess Leia, and a depiction of loyal bonds between comrades, the film repeatedly deflects attention and feeling away from these human relationships, particularly by constant deflation of the incipient love story. Aristotle would take an entirely different approach to droids, clearly distinguishing them from nature and people, who are at the apex of nature's hierarchy. He would classify R2-D2 or C-3PO as instruments of production. In The Politics, Aristotle seems to anticipate the likes of Empire's futuristic robotics, imagining how an instrument or robot could do its own work at the word of command or by intelligent anticipation, like the statues of Daedalus or the tripods made by Hephaestus. Clearly, Aristotle does not conceive of them as lovable creatures or like members of a family, something that Lucas is inclined to do. Placing Empire's robots in familiar human roles radically alters the nature of the audience experience by blurring the distinction between life and technology. To illustrate the extent to which Lucas preserves the experience of robots as characters, it's instructive to compare the composition of his group to a set of counterparts in the film version of The Wizard of Oz. The whining, worrying C-3PO is reminiscent of the lachrymose Tin Woodsman, who himself has all the appearance of a robot. The meddlesome R2-D2 sniffs out mischief like Dorothy's Toto. And, as if to emphasize these similarities, Chewbacca the Wookiee has a mane and a sentimental roar like the Cowardly Lion. And when C-3PO is shattered and then put back together, it scolds its mender in just the exasperated tones of the Scarecrow when Dorothy patiently replaces his straw. The parallel points up important differences in the way the characters appear to the audience. Frank Baum's story uses Dorothy's dream as a framework to distinguish fantasy from reality, as opposed to Lucas's depiction of a science fiction fantasy as real, even to the point of eschewing the usual preliminary credits. Instead of framing off the adventure as a fantasy, Lucas goes in the opposite direction by obliterating the frame and drawing the audience into the film's galaxy, dodging meteorites that fly off the screen, ducking explosions from stereo speakers surrounding them. However real the Tin Woodsman seems, he remains framed off within a dream,
When calculated, it is a reminder that the relationship between Dorothy and her friends, however delightful, remains clearly an imaginative experience from which Dorothy and the audience awake. The Empire Strikes Back strives for the opposite effect, which gives the robots and their human functions and relationships a strong sense of validity, often at the expense of real humans and real human relationships. I thought they smelled bad on the outside. The background of Parallels only highlights the differences in attitude, and nowhere more clearly than in Lucas's theme of humanizing technology. The theme builds gradually, so that through the course of the film, the technological marvels, at first so vast and various in this strange new galaxy, seem finally as familiar and indispensable as the family car. Indeed, Han and Chewbacca spend much of their time acting like mechanics tinkering with spaceships as if they were jalopies parked in the driveway. And like real driveway mechanics, their grease monkey antics often end in comic frustration and failure. The function of these comic moments is to give the objects of their tinkering a sense of the familiar and the ordinary. In the film, familiarization promotes acceptance of this futuristic technology, which ushers in an actual humanizing of its products, achieved with spectacular effect in R2-D2 and C-3PO. No longer simply handy pieces of technology, they become more than robots. Sometimes Mutt and Jeff comic figures, sometimes endangered and unsuspecting children. They arouse feelings at one moment of amused affection and at the next of concern. Apparently programmed to meddle and fret, C-3PO engages the audience's emotions in the very act of being an annoyance. It's as if technology has breathed the breath of life into its products, and not only in the robots. From a distance, what appears to be approaching monsters turn out to be AT-AT walkers, the elephantine troop transports of the Imperial Army. Even their destruction has a curious animal quality as they resist the most sophisticated rocket assault, only to be tripped up at their metal ankles and fall, heaving and shuddering on the ground. With the AT-ATs, technology imitates nature. In the robots, technology evokes responses enabling it to replace the flesh and blood of organic nature. Technology fills the vacuum created when real, living nature gets dramatically shoved aside early in the film, in a scene which Han Solo, mounted on a Tauntaun, rescues the wounded Luke Skywalker. Realizing that without heat, they won't survive the night in Hoth's frozen waste, Han sacrifices his mount by slicing it open so that Luke can use the creature's body heat by nestling in its opened guts. The sudden unexpectedness of Han slashing into the animal's flesh seems brutal, yet the act is presented as necessary for survival, and perfectly proper that man sacrifice beast to save a human life. This attitude accords with Aristotle's hierarchy of the natural order. The incident offers a possibility for making a dramatic use of the tradition of great steeds, from classics to cowboys, from Alexander the Great's historic Bucephalus to the Lone Ranger's fictional Silver. Such horses are justly seen as objects of admiration, and their riders would be saddened to lose them. Yet Han expresses a curious lack of feeling toward a living thing, and one that has served him without fail. His only response is sarcasm as he slices open the animal's belly, remarking, "I thought they smelled bad on the outside." At this point, the film turns away from creaturely flesh to the wonders of technology. How different is this view of animal flesh from that of Aristotle, who acknowledges that there are some animals which have no attractiveness for the senses, and that it is not possible without considerable disgust to look upon the blood, flesh, bones, blood vessels, and such like, but who nonetheless encourages the study of all animal life, knowing that in not one of them is nature or beauty lacking.
Luminous beings are we, not this crude matter.
The disdain for creaturely flesh and blood illustrates a view that repeatedly crops up in Lucas's film, the display of an absence of value placed on physical life or on the goodness of nature, which is replaced by a predilection for technology. Yoda, though separated from the technological action, speaks for many of the values expressed in the film, and his views give a clue to the basis for this preference. His initial physically repugnant appearance soon becomes a kind of corroboration for his status as a guru. He has something of the Eastern mystic about him. His isolation appears to be a backdrop for a life of ascetic contemplation, rather than a sign of alienated withdrawal. Yoda is seen finally as an embodiment of unselfish goodness, and thus a perfect mentor under whose guidance Luke achieves a heightened consciousness. But there is something more to Yoda's isolation. He seems to live in a world devoid of human emotion. Yoda warns Luke against the self-destructiveness of hate, but nowhere does he advocate love. The fruit of Yoda's training bears this out, though Luke shows loyalty, a quality he has demonstrated before becoming Yoda's pupil. Nowhere does he come to the sort of compassionate insight one might expect from an enlightened mind. Yoda